I wanted to welcome Rabbi Einhorn, and welcome to the Chevra here. We, as in previous years, we're just going to do tag team, Divrei Torah and Megillah. We're going to start with Rabbi Einhorn this year. He'll go first, and we'll just mix it up.
Okay. Thank you, Rabbi Brander. I welcome my parents, who are here as well. Shkoyach. It's an honor to be back here at the Link Kollel. And the share, I think this is our fourth year, right?
This is our fourth year we've been doing this.
So if you've been adding up all the gems that we've been doing each year, we're up to how many? 300? Something like
that.
At least 100. It's assuming no one's repeating each year.
Yeah, okay.
All right. We have spot check. We have fact checkers. Okay, so I want to share with the opening idea that everyone knows that the Purim story is defined by its fact as described in the Megillah of Venapochu, of that there was a turnaround. You thought it was going to go one way, and then it flipped and went the other way. So that sounds like a twist in the tale. And every great script has a twist in the tale. It's you expect one thing. What makes a banana peel slipping funny? The guy was walking, you didn't expect him, and then he fell. Right? That's a twist in the tale. That's how every great storyline. I remember when I was in high school. My mother took me to go take screenplay writing class at UCLA. You can't be a rabbi in L.A. unless you take screenplay writing class. So I took screenplay writing class in L.A. And the teacher taught us that every single scene in the script has to have some tension. So, like, for example, if you wake up in the morning and you're reaching for a cup of coffee, in the script, it's got to have you not reach it right away. Like a little bit of tension to keep the excitement. A twist. Create a twist in every scene. So I always thought that was the explanation of the Megillah's idea of Venapochu. Venapochu is a twist in the tale. Good story needs a twist in the tale. But I saw a teaching from Rav Huttner that I thought was so deep, a different translation of Venapochu. He says doesn't mean just a twist in the tale, stam. Rather, he says a better translation is a ricochet. A ricochet. What does that mean? So when you throw something against a wall, the force by which it's going to return to you is parallel to the amount of force that you threw, the velocity, the force that you threw at the wall when you threw that ball. So it ricochets and hits you. It's using the inertia and the energy, it's converting the energy that you put in initially, and it's coming back to get you. Rav Huttner says when you use that translation of Venapochu, it makes the story so much more miraculous. That every behavior done by Ahasuerus, done by Haman, everything that they put into it, it wasn't just a twist in the tail and it turned around. That energy was flipped around in the end against them. For example, think about the tree that Haman had. The very energy he put into dismantling the Jews was the energy that came back to get him. You know where a good example this is? Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu gets up and he speaks truth to power. Pharaoh, let my people go. Where did Moshe get such a audacity? Where did he get such a chutzpah? Right? To be able to speak to such a powerful human being. Sure, he was nervous first when he told God. But once God said, you're going in, there was no equivocating from Moshe. What gave him the strength and the courage to do something like that? The audacity. So you could say because God was by his side. I think there's something much simpler. Who raised Moshe? Paro raised Moshe. Who taught him how to speak to politicians? Paro taught Moshe. Who taught Moshe the language of the class of the upper class? Paro taught Moshe. The ultimate in ironies, that the very energy that Paro put into this Moshe, the very energy that Paro put in destroying the Jewish people, right? He had every firstborn, he had every male Jewish baby thrown into the water. So it's his energy that brought Moshe into his house. He raised him, gave him the teaching that he needed to one day dismantle his kingdom. That's Venapochu. Venapochu means that you take the very energy of the story itself, and God has a way of converting that energy into a matter that is able to dismantle the whole plan that they had against us. He doesn't just dismantle the plan. He uses their instrument the other way. That's Venapochu, according to Rav Huttner.
Beautiful. I want to also welcome the Einhorns. It's really great to have you here. You should be gesund. You should have nachas from your beautiful children. It's great to see everybody here. There's an interesting custom with regard to Purim. You can Google this, that's what I did, and you'll see that many local communities made their own Purim. When there was like something that happened, that the Chai Adam writes how there was this terrible fire, and much of his family, you know, didn't survive, and then he survived, and some members did, and they made a Seuda on the 15th day of Kislev, and it was called the Purim of the Chai Adam. Or, if you look further in history, or go back in history, you'll see there was the Purim of Cairo in 1524, where the Radbaz, the chief rabbi of Egypt, was imprisoned, and there was a lot of danger to the community, and something happened, and there was a sense that the Jews will all be massacred. The leader promised, Suleiman promised to massacre all the Jews, and somehow they get out of it. And they called it Purim Cairo, the 28th of Adar. And you go throughout history, Purim Saragossa, Spain, Purim Padua, you know, Rabbi Einhorn made Purim Yula when he survived the Rabbeim.
I'm great Rabbi, especially.
Yeah, you know. Purim Tiberia, Purim Tripoli, Purim, Purim Shiraz. It's a very interesting thing. You don't have Hanukkah this and Hanukkah. It's just Purim. What does that teach us about the nature of Purim? So I want to share with you a great Vort opening idea. And really, the Vort, this isn't just a Vort. And everything that's going to be said here will have a practical end, because there's an avoda of Purim. There's something that should be accomplished on Purim. So the Vilna Gaon quotes a famous Gemara in Megillah Daf Yud Zayin. The Gemara in Megillah, page 17, says that if you're korei es ha-Megillah l'mafreya, lo yotza. If you read the Megillah out of order, like in reverse order, you haven't fulfilled your obligation. Which means, by the way, if you come late to the Megillah reading, you can't like make it up at the end, because you've read the first part out of order. You have to read the whole Megillah. You should read it quickly and then catch up. But the other way doesn't work. So what is that about? Why would somebody like want to read it out of order? Well, what's that about? So the Vilna Gaon explained, it's brought down in the Panini Hagra, something very special. That, you know, there are always people who want to read the end of the book first. Because, like, you know, like it's just too long. It's like, you know, 720 pages, and the most I read was like 10 pages. You just go to like the last three pages, see how it worked out. So that's when that phenomena of reading the book, reading the end of the book first, the halacha says you can't do that. But why not? It's a story. We want to know how the story ends. So go to the end of the story, and then you'll finish it up, you'll fill in the details. What's wrong with that? So the Vilna Gaon explains, the Gemara derives it from a pasuk in the Megillah, that these days have to be nizkarim v'na'asim. Listen carefully. Here's the key word. These days have to be nizkarim v'na'asim. That means to say that just like the nature of a day, the nature of time is that it marches on inexorably. Time doesn't simply like, let me go to the end of the day first and then I'll come back in the beginning. We're in a place called time. Hayomim ha'ila nizkarim v'na'asim, says the Gemara. Just like the time has to go in a particular order, so too the Megillah is like real time. The Megillah is like real time. That means to say, you think that the Megillah is a story of history? The Megillah isn't a story of history. The Megillah is the ongoing saga of Jewish history. If you read the Megillah at the end, you skip to the end, what you're really saying is that the Megillah is just a one-off. But really, Purim is the ultimate emblem of the Jewish survival in exile. Purim is, how is the Jew going to survive from Purim till the end of Jewish history? Purim is, in the language of the Gemara, it's the Sof Kol HaNisim. It's the morning star. Esther actually means the morning star, Ayelet HaShachar. It's the light, the little bit of light in the darkest time of the night. That's what Purim is. So if you read the Megillah like a history book, it means that you're missing the essence. The essence of Purim is, it's the ongoing nature of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the world. That's the avoda of Purim. Where is HaKadosh Baruch Hu in your life? That says the Vilna Gaon. That's the Indian. That's the reason why we can't read the Megillah Mafreya. And that, I think, is also the reason why the custom developed Purim Saragossa and Purim Tripoli and Purim, you know, and Purim Chai Adam and Purim, because it's all about the ongoing presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our life.
Beautiful. Pati Avdei Achashverosh.
Yeah, that's it. We're still.
Okay, it says in the Megillah, Perek Gimel, Pasuk Vav, chapter 3, verse 6, Vayivaz ve'einav lishloach yad b'Mordechai levado. And it was, you know, disgraced in his eyes to put his hand on Mordechai alone. He couldn't just put his hand on Mordechai alone. Vayivaz ve'einav.
Who's that?
What?
Who couldn't?
Haman. Okay. Haman. Haman had to get the rest of them. Yeah. So the Medrash says on that Pasuk that Haman was Bozui ben Bozui. Right, from Vayivaz. He was the denigrating one, the son of the denigrating one. Why, where's the other famous time the Vayivaz is used in the Torah? By Esav, by his own birthright. When Esav gave it away. Vayisav, Esav, and the Bechorah. Esav gave away his birthright. It meant nothing to him. It was nothing. So the Midrash links the Vayivaz of Haman to kill, it's not, he couldn't just kill Mordechai. He had to get them all. The same Vayivaz is linked to Esav's Vayivaz. How are they linked, besides the word being the same? What has one got to do with the other? It says in the Sefer Ginzei HaMelech by Rav Ginzburg. Says the Ginzei HaMelech. When Esav sold his birthright for some lentil soup and stew, what was he saying? He was basically saying, I don't value the belief that others had in me of what I was capable of doing. As the firstborn, as the birthright, I had a certain faith that's held in me by other people that I am capable of great things. Certainly in that family. The legacy of Avraham and Yitzchak, certainly in that family. But by getting rid of it, he didn't believe in the value of what he was capable of doing. He didn't see anything special in his destiny, and therefore was able to give it away for soup and lentil soup. The same thing with Haman. Haman said, I can't just do it. It's not worth it for me to make a whole hullabaloo for one person, for Mordechai. It's not worth it. What do you mean it's not worth it? If he would have understood that one man, along with a woman, was going to orchestrate the whole undoing of what he was going to do, he would have realized, like Esav, the power that one human being has. The power that every human being has is the same thing that both Esav and what Haman both missed, and what they both understated. They both missed this idea, the potential and the power that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives for one person to change the entire world. You know, there's a discussion that you're supposed to give up your life. Right, if someone says, send us this person over and we'll spare you all. You don't give them that person if they name who they are. Unless they're deserving of a capital offense, maybe. But you don't give up that person. You don't throw them out. Right? Shiva ben Bichri, famous sugya. I learned it first, Rabbi Brander. Remember that packet, the YU packet? Remember that? So I learned it first, Rabbi Brander. So you don't send them forward just like that. You don't give it up. So why not? What is the reason for that? Like, think about it. Pragmatically, kill one guy, you save the masses. Throw them. They want anybody. They want you to give them one guy. Pick anybody. Throw them out. Give it to him and you'll save 100 people. So you could say that Judaism, the philosophy of Judaism, is not what you call pragmatic philosophy, but rather there's some bigger factor at work. That God says, these are my rules. But I was thinking about it a little further and I thought maybe this is the chop, why you don't do it. You know why you don't give that one person to save 1,000 people in Judaism? It's not because Judaism says we don't calculate or I have another cheshbon, God says, but rather for the following reason. The Gemara in Sanhedrin says, whoever saves a life, it's as though they've saved the entire world. That means every single life has infinite value. If every single life has infinite value, so infinite value plus infinite value is still infinity. By you giving up one Jew, you're not saving more value than by keeping that one Jew. Infinity plus infinity is infinity. If you understand that every human being is embedded with eternality and infinity, there's no gain by giving him that one person. So I think that's why you don't give that one person forward to save the masses at the end of the day. And that's what Haman and Esav didn't realize, the power of one individual person.
Wow. So I want to... The reason why I like this format because we can just like, you know, work off the same sukkim sometimes. Oh. So I want to share with you what the Ger Rebbe says on that pasuk. So if you take a look, if you want to see it inside, it's really beautiful. On page 1255. So again, Haman, it was like this. He didn't want to just get rid of Mordechai. Why not? So look what it says here. Let's look at the sukkim. The simple word of the Sfas Emes, and then listen to how it resonates in Jewish history. Ki higidu lo es am Mordechai. Why didn't he want to just get rid of Mordechai? Because they told Haman about the Am Mordechai. Says the Gemara, who is the Am Mordechai? Anybody know? The Am Mordechai refers to What's that? Oh, right, well, yeah. It refers to the Rabbanan, the rabbis, the Torah scholars, the leaders. So what does it mean? He didn't want to get rid of Mordechai because they told him about the Am Mordechai. How does that flow? Says the Sfas Emes, because he understood that Mordechai was not the only one. V'afilu im yamis es Mordechai yihye acher b'mekomo. V'lachein rotza la'aved kol Am Mordechai. Because he understood, and this is one of the most beautiful ideas in the eternity of the Jewish people. When I walk into this base, man, sometimes I'll see 10-year-old kids learning. And it's like an amazing thing. You walk in and you see, like, these kids, they come with their bikes, and, like, you know, they put their helmets, and then they start learning Mishnah. And then you walk and you see a 30-year-old. You see a 70-year-old. Klal Yisrael has an eternal wellspring of connection to Torah. So Haman understood something very powerful. Haman understood that it's not enough to get rid of Mordechai. You know why? Because it's not just Mordechai. There's a whole Am of Mordechai. And if I get rid of Mordechai alone, it's not going to help. Somebody else is going to take up the mantle. In October 25th, 1940, a memorandum dated, dispatched by the Nazis to the Nazi district governors in occupied Poland. The central office of the German security forces instructed the Nazis not to grant exit visas to the oust student, the Eastern European Jews. This is before the final solution. Don't allow the Eastern European Jews to leave. Why? Because, listen to what it says here, the Nazis feared that because they, the Orthodoxen Einstellung, the Orthodox Jews, these oust Juden would provide the Rabbiner and Talmud Lehrer, the rabbis and teachers of the Talmud, who would create the Geistige, I'm not going to pronounce it right, Erneuerung, the spiritual regeneration of the Jews in America. So the Nazis were not interested in simply just destroying the Jews in Poland. They wanted to get rid of the Jews. So what did they say? Make sure you don't allow the rabbis to leave Eastern Europe. Because if you do that, we know that's what happened. Panovich Rav went, and Rav Aaron Kotler went, and what did they do? And they rebuilt Judaism. So what did Mordechai Haman say? I can't just get rid of one Mordechai because there's a whole Am of Mordechai. I have to get rid of all of them. That's what the Sfas Emes is. That's beautiful.
A couple years ago, I had the privilege of meeting. I went to a kibbutz in Israel, and I met at 1 o'clock in the morning after the midnight Kabbalah shir. There was a midnight Kabbalah shir given by a rav by the name.
Nasty, no?
What? Okay. No, no. Okay. But I mean, always meeting people at midnight.
Okay.
By the name of Rav Menachem Froman. Rav Menachem Froman was a very interesting figure in Israel. He used to wear a white bekesher and a white shtreimel, all in white. And he passed away a year ago from cancer. His book that he wrote is called Tein Li Zman, Give Me Time. It's a beautiful, beautiful sefer. And he has here, I imagine this to be an imaginary conversation, called Sicha, this just came out, Sicha Im Shikur. Conversation with the drunkard on Purim. So I'm going to keep it's a lengthy story, I'll just keep it short. It says, Mesimas Purim Tafsani Shikur Mesumam, a specific, a certain shikur grabbed onto me. One hand of his was holding onto a bottle of wine, and the other one was grabbing onto my coat like he was going to rip it. And he screamed at me. And he said, you religious Jews, right? You're right, but you don't even know why. And he goes, what don't we know? And he goes into knocking the religious Jew, Reb Froman. He says, you guys box everybody in. Everything's got to be black and white. You take every beautiful thing and you make it into categories and boxes where you can't even breathe and you can't even move. And the guy was just screaming and giving it to Menachem Froman. And Menachem Froman was going back and forth. A beautiful exchange that we don't have the time now to go through. But a back and forth. He's saying, what do you mean? We live with simplicity and clarity. It's not simplicity and clarity. It's simplisticness. Right? You're making everything too simple, but it should be elegant and beautiful. Back and forth. He says, but you said we're right. What are we right about? He says, you're right because you're holding on to the Mesorah, the legacy of your fathers and your grandfathers and your grandmothers. You're holding on to a chain that goes all the way back. So he goes, if we're holding on to a chain that goes all the way back, where do we go wrong? And you know what he says? Something incredible. The drunkard says this. He says, remember that day when you had to fool your brother Esav, your father Yitzchak, by pretending to be Esav? You put on clothing to pretend you were him. And you needed to do that then, because you knew that you needed the blessings. You understood that if it went into Esav's hands, it would be the wrong hands. But guess what? You never bothered to take off the costume. What a powerful thought. You never bothered to take off the costume and remember who you truly were and what you truly stood for. And at the end, Rabbi Nachman Froman says, it was then that I understood why we wear costumes in Purim and Adda Lo Yada. The notion of losing yourself for a moment, losing yourself in the costume, to remind us and to remind ourselves that the moment we put on Esav's clothes, something happened to us, and we have to remember to take it off, because we're truly Yaakov. We are not Esav. We sometimes in history have to pretend to be something we're not in order to stay strong, in order to keep our identity. But essentially, you have to remember what you truly are in your core and what you represent and never be afraid of that. And that's the Adda Lo Yada element of Purim. Yes?
What's the source?
Yeah. What's it? Rabbi Nachum Froman, book Tein Li Zman, Give Me Time.
I think that's a very powerful idea. B'chlal, many people dress up wearing other people's identity.
Yeah.
And to really plug into who we are, this is one of the most important avodas.
Stranger.
Very, very important avoda of Purim and the rest of the year. Something to really plug into. It could be that the costume is liberating. Mm-hmm. It allows you to mask yourself to the rest of the world, and then you can think about who you are. Maybe it gives you time to operate. Maybe. I want to share with you a few cute gematrias. Because you always have to have some gematrias on Purim. And gematria is like the numeric equivalent to a few words. And these all come from Rav Chaim Kanievsky, but there's one at the end that's really stunning. So first, some of the classic. Nichnas yayin. Wine comes in. And what comes out? What?
Secrets.
Yayin is 70. And sod, secrets. Wine comes in, and secrets come out. Classic. Number one. Number two. Arur Haman. Baruch Mordechai. Arur Haman, Baruch Mordechai. Cursed is Haman, blessed is Mordechai. That's 502. Number three, this is less classic. Arura Zeresh, cursed is Zeresh. Esther Libracha. Esther for a bracha. Same gematria. What's the gematria? You do the math, you'll tell me. I didn't do it yet. Charvona. Vehu Zachur Latov. Charvona, that's the one that gave the information to Achashverosh at the right time, and he is remembered for the good. What's striking to me is they all are binary. They're polar opposites, right? There's Arur Haman, and there's Baruch Mordechai. There's Arura Zeresh and Esther Lebracha. There's Yayin and there's Sod. Secret you shouldn't reveal, right? But it's interesting. Is Charvona good? Charvona not good? According to one strong opinion of Chazal, Charvona wasn't a good guy. He was actually an anti-Semite also. Charvona, v'hu zachor latov. Right? You have sometimes what seems to be a bad guy can produce really good results. That's part of the Indian Purim. Now listen to this. So those are four classic and interesting gematrias to think about, which is part of what Purim is about, is that we don't really know when something is good or not good. Like, we don't really have the full picture. Right? After Mordechai tells Achashverosh about the plot, so it seems like he should get some reward, end of chapter 2, right after that, beginning of chapter 3, Achashverosh raises Haman to great heights. Well, what's that? Mordechai seems to be like the schlepper. He's the one that... But the Mefarshim explained, no. Hashem, once Mordechai did what he had to do, Hashem planted the refuah, the healing, then he could bring about the makkah, then he could bring about the punishment because he already has worked it out. So you never know where it's going to come from. But says Rav Chaim Kanievsky, he adds another point, which is amazing. And people are going to be blown away by this, but just stay with me. How old was Mordechai when the Purim story happened? So, it's really math. If we work out the Megillah, you'll see an amazing thing here. Rav Chaim Kanievsky says, we know that Mordechai came to Paras and Madai, we're told in the Megillah, when he came. He came with what's called, again, you have to know a little bit of the history, I'm just going to say it quickly. He came Galus Yechanya. Galus Yechanya, which is before the destruction of the temple, 11 years before, is when Mordechai came
when he came to Paras and Madai. He was in Persia Mid for a total of 70 years by the time Ahasuerus had the second year of his reign. So he's already in Persia Mid. It's just simple mathematics here. For 70 years before Esther has become a queen. For 70 years. And we know, according to Chazal, that he was a member of the Sanhedrin before he came to Persia Mid. And you can't be a member of the Sanhedrin until you first became a local judge, and then you have to join the Sanhedrin of 23, and then you have to go become a member of the Sanhedrin, the court in the Azara of the courtyard, and then you could be a member of the Sanhedrin, and you have to start at 13. So he's at least 15 years old when he comes to, at least 15 years old, in Elui, when he comes to Persia Mede, he's 70 years plus, he's 85, year 2. The Haman plot is year 12. The Haman plot is year 12. You have to, it's in the Megillah. He's 95 years old. Now here, listen to this amazing thing. The Gemara says that when Haman and Mordechai have the conversation, when Haman is trying to take him on the horse, so Haman says, Mordechai, get up on the horse. So Mordechai says, I'm old, I can't get up on the horse. Haman says, you're old. I'm just as old as you. Haman in Gematria is 95. Haman's an old man also. Chazal say, how old was Esther?
50.
So there are three opinions in Chazal. But just look, working at the pshat, if Mordechai adopted Esther, before she came to Persia Mede, if Mordechai adopted Esther when he was 15, at the very beginning of the Persia Mede, or right at the end of being in Bavel, the very end of his Babylonian stay, how old is Esther? Mm-hmm. Esther had to have been like 70 or 75. Three opinions in the Medrash Rabbah. One opinion says that she was 74, same gematria as Hadassah. Hadassah is 70. We're going with the gematrias. Hadassah is 74. Another opinion is that she was 75, just like Avram Avinu when he started his trek. Another opinion is that she was 80. And then there's another opinion that she was 40. So you want to know, no, I didn't see 50. So you want to understand the incredible miracle of what happened here. She's going against the 18-year-olds, right? And Haman and Mordechai, it puts a totally different picture on this. You know, Haman isn't like, he's, I want to tell you one more thing here. Old people, remember this, I don't know if I know remembers, we used to go visit the nursing homes. There was a woman by the name of Cindy Max. She taught us how to visit the nursing homes. And so one of the kids asked her, how are old people? So she said an amazing thing. She said, old people are very. If they were nice when they're young, they're very nice when they're older. If they were kvetchy when they're young, they're very kvetchy when they're older.
That's good.
They're very. There's nothing more pathetic than a 95-year-old man who still can't come to terms with his own identity. I can have everything in the world that's worth nothing. Right, that's the like the patheticism of an old man who can't get a grip on his taiva and on his kavod. That's the picture by looking carefully at the numbers. So just to review the gematrias, Yayin is Sod, Aru Haman is Baruch Mordechai, Aru is Eresh Esther Lebracha, Chavona Hu Zocher Latov, and Haman 95, which is Mordechai. Beautiful inside Rav Chaim Kanievsky.
Beautiful. Ish Yehudi haya b'shushan ibira u'shmo Mordechai ben Yar ben Shimi ben Kish ish Yemini. Ish Yehudi means he's from the tribe of Yehuda. Ish Yemini means he's from the tribe of Binyamin. The Talmud asks, which one is he? Is he from Yehuda or is he from Binyamin? So the Talmud answers that on his mother's side, he was from Yehuda. On his father's side, he was from Binyamin. Good, nice answer. The problem with that answer is that in Judaism, we don't really care what tribe your mother was. Meaning, in terms of Judaism, whether you're Jewish or not Jewish, we don't really care who your father is. We care who your mother is. But in terms of tribal affiliation, we care who your father is. So why does it tell me what tribe his mother is? Okay? This past Shabbos at Shalashudas, I had a surprise visitor that was called Friday that he's in town, and was the son of Rav Avigdor Nevinsol. Rav Nevinsol, currently in one of the top gedolim in the world. And his son, Rav Chizkiyahu Nevinsol, who I never got to meet before, real tzaddik, real wonderful person and a Talmud Chacham, and he told over a teaching from his father on this question at Shalashudas. Incredible. Incredible. He said, the Gemara in Bava Basra asks, what does it mean when we say Einei Lea Rachos, that Lea's eyes were soft, Rachos, what does that mean? So one opinion of the Gemara says that Matanos Aruchos, that the gifts she was given were lengthy, Aruchos, Rachos from Aruchos. Rashbam, which is the main commentary on the side of Bava Basra, says that look at the gifts Lea was given. From her came the Kohanim, the Levium, the kingdom. Those things were eternal. So the gift of Lea was eternality. Eternality. Why did she have that ability? So you look at the other opinion in the Gemara, which says why her eyes were soft. Because she was crying. Because she thought she was going to marry Esav. And she was crying the whole time. And in the merit of her tears, her pleading to God, she got a special shidduch. Now wait a second, her shidduch was the same as her sister. They both got Yaakov. But the idea was that Leah's attachment came through tears, through longing, through wanting. And therefore, because of that, whatever came from her had a greater and more eternal kium. It lasted so much longer, it lasted for more time. By the way, now you take that idea, you could run with it. The idea of the eternality of Leah, all the things that come from Leah. You talk about meaning from Leah is Yehuda. And therefore the base of Migdash, the Mishkan Shiloh, which was conquered, Israel originally was conquered by Yoshua. Yoshua came from Binyamin. Binyamin was a child of Rachel. The original sanctity of Joshua did not last. It was a temporary sanctity, the land of Israel. You look at the sanctity in King David's time, King David who came from Yehuda, and that sanctity, Kitchel Ashaisa, Kitchel Asidlavo, that sanctity lasted forever because it came from Leah, from the tribe of Leah, because hers came through tears, through crying, through longing. So now we have a drusha in the Gemara Megillah that the days of Purim will not pass from among our people. Meaning Purim is one of those holidays that's going to last even after the end of time. Why is Purim going to last? Because not only was Mordechai Ish Yemini from Binyamin, he was Ish Yehudi. He was from Yehuda, from Leah. His mother gave him the gift of tefillah, the gift to be able to cry over a problem so that it should last for eternity. And that's why Purim stays with us, Lenetzach Netzachim, forever and ever. That beautiful Rav Nevinsol.
I just came for that part of the worship.
Oh, man. Go ahead.
Okay, please take a look. Chapter 5. This is the chapter 5, verse 12. Page 12. Where is it here? Page 1257. So, here's a little bit of context. We're between party 1 and party 2. Right? In other words, Esther invited Haman and Ahasuerus to party 1. And then Esther invited Ahasuerus and Haman to party 2. We're going to talk about later on why did she have to do the double party. We'll get to that. And by the way, when Ahasuerus' sleep is interrupted, that's actually in between party 1 and party 2. In other words, chapter 6 is the interruption of his sleep. That's right after he was invited to party 2, but he hasn't yet attended it. Right, that's how all the action happens between that 24-hour period. So, after Haman was invited to party 2 already, so let's take a look at verse 9 and then verse 12. Vayetze Haman vayomahu sameach v'tov lev. He was very happy, glad-hearted. V'chiros Haman as Mordechai b'shar ha-melech v'okam b'lo zam imenu. When he sees Mordechai at the gate, not moving, not stirring, Vayimalei Haman al Mordechai chema. He internally was full of anger. Well, the Gaon says there are two terms for anger. There's the internal anger that's called chema, hot on the inside. And there's ketzef, like whipped cream, whipped. That's on the outside. Internal anger. Verse 12. Vayomer Haman, I'm skipping a little bit. He goes back to his wife. He says, Aflo hevia Esther I'm the only one invited. And even tomorrow I'm being called. Tomorrow, just me and the king and Esther. And listen to this line. This is, in many ways, this is the line I can relate most to in the Megillah. And none of this matters to me. B'chol eis asher ani ro'eh es Mordechai ha-Yehudi yoshe b'shar ha-melech. I can have it all. I can have it all. But I'm the man. Me, Esther, and Achashverosh. I have all the power. I'm the de facto king. But the moment I see Mordechai there, when I see him there, it's nothing means anything to me. It's all worthless. Let's stop for a minute. A very cryptic Gemara. Gemara Chulin 139. Famous Gemara. Where is Haman in the Torah? Gemara asks, where is Haman in the Torah? Like, it's a game? What do you mean? Haman's not in the Torah. Haman's after the Torah. Says the Gemara, Hamin ha'etz. Haman in the Torah, Hamin ha'etz. Was it from the tree? What's that, like a random thing? Hamin, it's like a game? Yeah, take the letter, hey, mem, nun. What's going on there? So listen to an amazing idea. What is that line talking about? That's Gan Eden. And Adam is asked by Hashem, did you take from the tree that I told you not to take from? Hamina eats. Asher sivisi levilti yacham lenu achalta. Did you eat from that tree? What? That's Haman. Why is that Haman? That's Adam. Why is that Haman? Says the Meshech Chachma. What was the first commandment that Adam was given? It's a trick question. The first commandment Adam was given was not don't eat from the tree. The first, can you look it up? Look it up yourself. You'll see it there. The first commandment was, Mikol eitz hagan achol tochal. You can eat, you should eat, you must eat from all the fruits of the tree. From all the trees. I'm giving you a tremendous thing. You must eat from all the fruit trees. Except for one. Except for one. And what did Adam and Chava do? That was the one that they wanted, right? Haman min haTorah minayin. Where do we see that nature of Haman in the Torah? Haman had everything. Haman had everything. 1994, Palm Springs, my first Pesach program. Beautiful purple mountains, unbelievable facility, beautiful tennis courts, amazing. It was the first time I'd heard about this tea room. I couldn't find the tea, but everything else, you know, they chocolates and cakes. And this was before, today it's even better. And I remember a woman walks in and she's like so disappointed. She's like, I spent all my money. Look at all the, what are you disappointed about? You have the cake, you have the cookies and the chocolates. They brought Bazooka Bubblegum from New York. They brought Cosmo Bays of Coke. She said, I can't believe I spent all this money. Where's the squirt? Where's the squirt? The soda. Where's the squirt? The human being's capacity to see what they don't have in the context of everything they do have, that's Haman and that's Hamina Eitz. It began from the very essential nature of the human being. Now, I want to take this one step further. We're going to go deeper in a minute after we hear about Einhorn again, but I want to take this one step further. Listen to this amazing thing. If you take a look at that phrase, V'chol ze inenu shovali, in the text, 1257, look, Rabbeinu Bachai points this out in Bamidbar chapter 1, verse 51. Take a look at that phrase, V'chol ze inenu shovali. The last letter of the word li is yud. The last letter of the word shoveh is hey. The last letter of the word einenu is vav. The last letter of the word ze is hey. Yud, then a hey, then a vav, then a. The four-letter name of God in reverse. What does that have to do with anything? What's this four-letter? You won't find this too often in all of Tanakh. The four-letter name of God in reverse. We'll leave it with that cliffhanger. We'll go
where
better
is that one line?
You'll have to take a look. Well, I'll tell you later. Let's go on. Yeah, very mean.
That's cold.
Yeah.
Okay, you mentioned the second party that was thrown. So about that second party, it says in chapter 7, verse 8, Perek Zayin, Pasuk Ches, V'hamelech shav meginas habisan abes mishta yayin. Achashverosh came back from the party. V'haman nofel alamita asher Esther aleh. Haman fell on the bed that Esther was there. They used to eat on individual beds back then. V'yomer hamelech hagam lichbosh et amalke imibayit. You also trying to conquer my wife over here? You're actually taking my household like this? He was accusing him of rape. Ask the Lubavitcher Rebbe. It was obvious Haman was drunk. He just fell down. Why did Achashverosh go nuts and jump to conclusions like this? Says the Lubavitcher Rebbe, just a great insight. He says this was Esther's brilliance. Esther knew that Achashverosh was an insecure man. So what did she do? In chapter 5, Perek Hey, Pasuk Zayin, Pasuk Chet, she invites Haman, Achashverosh, to a party with Haman. Im matzati chein be'inei ha-melech, right? If you want to give me what I'm asking for, Yavo ha-melech, why don't you come and Haman? You saw what she was doing there? She was planting the seed in his head. Wait, what's going on here? You know, it's like, I was in a position once of trance, you know, a change of leadership. And so you start convening a team of people, right, around you. And then all of a sudden, everyone looks to see who's going to get invited to the second meeting. Uh-oh. Wait a second. Why is that person also coming to the second meeting? I thought I have a special spot. Why is that person at the second meeting? That's exactly what she was doing. She knew I can turn this whole story around if I can keep elevating. She was elevating Haman. She's inviting him to all the parties. So Lubavitcher Rebbe says what she was doing was, instead of doing the simple thing, which is tell Achashverosh, stop Achashverosh, he's a bad man, leave him out of this. She did the opposite. She knew the way to get him was to play into Achashverosh's insecurity. Keep building up Haman in Achashverosh's eyes till he's getting so powerful that by the time Achashverosh sees he's invited to the second party by my wife, and now he's laying on my wife, it's over for Haman. There's no turning back. And all that was orchestrated by Esther's brilliance.
So I just want to play off that for a moment, just to bring a proof to what Rabbi Einhorn said from Rav Chaim Kanievsky.
Oh.
Listen, if you could look inside, it's so you'll get so much more when you look inside. There are two parties I pointed out, right? Take a look on page 1256. It's an amazing deal. The idea that Rabbi Einhorn said is that Achashverosh, that Esther was playing off the insecurity of Achashverosh and Haman. Right, that's the playing off. In fact, the Gemara makes the exact point that after the second, between the first and second party, Achashverosh says, "What's going on here?" What, like, and he says, "Like, maybe there's a setup here, there's collusion, and but would somebody tell me about it? Well, is there anybody that saved my life that I didn't reward?" And then it gets that's like the Gemara makes that transition because the Gemara sees the insecurity of Achashverosh, and Esther understood this. But let's look how Rav Chaim sees this in the Pesukim. Look at chapter 5, verse 4. Vatomer Esther says to the king, Im al ha-melech tov, if it's good for the king, yavo ha-melech v'hayom el ha-mishteh, let the king and Haman come to the party, asher asiti lo, which I made for him, meaning for the melech, for the king. She's speaking to the king in third person. I mean, all wives speak to their husband in third person, right?
Sure.
So, okay, we'll leave that comment for... Right, so the... That was up. I know how to say that. So the so, but now let's look at chapter 5, verse 8. Second party, because in the first party he says, "Well, what can I do for you?" So he says, "She says, look, im matzasi chein beinei hamelech, if I find grace in the eyes of the king, im hamelech tov laseis hashem lazivah to fulfill my wish, yavo hamelech vehaman el hamishte, let the melech and Haman come to the party, asher eseh lahem." The party that I'm no longer doing just for him, not just for you, my melech, but I'm doing the party for who? For you and him. She puts Haman and Achashverosh on equal footing. No. That's when he went crazy. That's what Rav Chaim says. That's sort of like what's going on. They're like Esther's planting the seed. The Gemara has like 12 different answers why she invited the Haman and Achashverosh to the party. One of them was exactly that. To plant the seeds. It's a very beautiful, beautiful diuk, really corroborating what Ryan had to say.
So we know the Megillah teaches us about the different responsibilities of Purim. Mishloach manos ish l'reihu, matanas levyonim. We have a concept of a suda, and we have mikra Megillah. Right? Those four are in the Megillah, four obligations with divrei sofrim that one is obligated to fulfill on Purim itself. So at face value, when you look at them, it seems very straightforward. Looks like exactly like any other Jewish holiday. We have some tzedakah in there, matanas levyonim, tzedakah. We always believe in charity, right? Mishloach manos, camaraderie, gathering together, like in shul, camaraderie. And then we have reading a Megillah, a scroll. We always have a good book we read on every Jewish holiday. And then we have a Suda, a feast. We always believe, right? They wanted to kill us. We survived. Let's eat. We have that by every Yontif. So Purim really is so similar, except for the fact that it's not, you could do malacha, you could do labor. It really is very similar to every other Jewish holiday. But then when you scratch the surface a little bit, you realize the whole thing is off. First of all, the tzedakah thing, matanas levyonim, it's not tzedakah at all. Why? The rules are all different here. During the week, if a poor person comes to you and asks for charity, and for whatever reason you just don't feel it right now, you're not feeling it, you can say no. You're allowed to say no. You ought to give, but you can say no. On Purim, kol haposhet yad nosdim lo. Whoever sticks out their hand, you give them. Okay? That's the Yom Kippurim, by the way. Tikkun Zohar, Yom Kippurim. Why? Because kol haposhet yad. By Hashem. Okay? So, number one, it's kol haposhet yad nosdim lo. Whoever asks, you give them. So right away, the tzedakah thing is off. Okay, let's go to the Mishloach Manos thing. That seems nice and social. You never have a mitzvah where you're giving to people who have. It's a mitzvah for you to give to people who have. Usually when you give, it's to people who don't have. Mishloach Manos is specifically, so much so, the Chai Adam says that if someone is used to a very fancy level steak and you give them a lower level steak, you're not Yotze. So it's a mitzvah designed to give to people that have. Totally off. Okay, at least maybe the reading of the Megillah. That's benign. Guess what? There's an opinion in the Shulchan Aruch that if you know you're going to be gone on a cruise and you're not going to have access to a Megillah, you could read already from Rosh Chodesh Adar. Right? You could read from the beginning of the month. You can't do that by any other Yontif. You don't say, you know what? You're going to be gone. They're not going to have Svarim there. Maybe read a month earlier.
Well, the Shofar.
What?
Well, the Shofar.
Shofar yesterday, but right by Megillah. Right by Megillah, you don't have such an idea that you would do this all the way in advance. By any scroll, by any other reading, you don't have it. So that's also off. At least we have our Suda. Our Suda, that's nice. No one messes with that. That's like every other Yontif. This is totally different than any other meal. Every other Suda is just for the purpose of Simchas Yontif, to enjoy the Yontif. Here, it's Adalo Yada. You drink or you get to a point where you don't know what's going on anymore. You're totally out of it. And that's the shear of how you know when you've been Yotze the Suda. So what's happening over here? This whole Purim is, by the way, those four are good just to bring up your Purim Sudas for discussion. Why everything is off on Purim. Everything seems like you know what it is, and then it's off. But just regarding the Suda, I want to share with you the Maral. Maral is a great idea. Why Adalo Yada? So you know why? He says because every reason you give of why they hate the Jewish people. They hate us because we're brilliance, right? So says the Maral, get rid of all that. Get rid of all that. You drink, it's not about your mind. It's not about your beliefs. It's not about your ideology. It's just you as a living human being. It's just you because you're a Jew. And a Jew is saying on Purim, I'm celebrating. My simcha is I'm choosing to live. I'm choosing life. That's the Simcha of Purim. I'm giving to friends, even though they have, because we're choosing to celebrate. We're choosing life. I'm giving to anybody who asks, because I'm letting them live on Purim. I'm choosing life. Everything we do on Purim is the same answer over and over. Maral says this. The decision to choose life over what could have been a hatred to just keeping vengeance, every single day vengeance. Instead, the Jew turned what should have been a dark day. Purim could have been a day filled with vengeance every year. Instead, we turned into a day of celebration. Because that's how a Jew commemorates, by celebrating life.
Beautiful. Which is a perfect segue to finishing up the vort that I said before. Remember we said, Haman in the Torah. Where do we see Haman in the Torah? And we connected it back to the Gan Eden. And we said, because Haman's whole thing is what? Is that he has everything, but he's missing one thing, and he doesn't have his squirt, and it's like, and that's Gan Eden, you have all the trees, but the one, that's how we explain that Gemara. And then we pointed out at the very end that what? That the four-letter name of God is embedded in the phrase, V'chol Zeh Neinu Shoveli, right? It's backwards. And I told you, Rabbeinu Bechaya says something mystical here. Rabbeinu Bechaya was a student of the Ramban. And Rabbeinu Bechaya says that whenever you find the four-letter name of God that's embedded backwards, it means it's a time of great judgment that's happening. What does he mean? So perhaps we can give the following idea. You know that it's well known that the Rambam has 13 principles of faith. But the truth is he really has 14 principles of faith. And I'm not making it up. If you look in Hilchos Tshuva, the Rambam tells us that there's one principle which is really above all the rest. The Rambam says, he calls this in chapter 5 in the Laws of Tshuva, the Rambam says that what I'm going to tell you now is the Ikar Gadol. It's the most important principle of Judaism. V'hu Amud HaTorah V'HaMitzvah. It is the very pillar of Torah and mitzvos. What is that principle that the Rambam is talking about? It's the same principle that the Meshech Chachma tells us, or what he calls the Tzelem Elokim. What's the principle? The principle is free will. Bechira. Free will. In fact, we can talk about this another time. I would maintain that one of the greatest assaults of contemporary society is on this principle. That's the way I am. I can't change it. That's the way I feel. That's the way I am. Bechira. Bechira chavshis means that I am in control. I it could be I have predilections, inclinations. I have natural states of being. But Bechira means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave me the ability, and that is the very essence of Tzelem Elokim, to chart my destiny. In fact, without going into the details, Meshech Chachma says that's why when Hashem created man, it says that he spoke to his heart. He spoke privately, as if God diminished himself. He didn't speak out loud because he had to give man room to operate, to function. So where is their judgment? Judgment is dafka manifested when a human being has a choice. Haman is about to look. He looks at Mordechai. He has a choice. He can choose to be miserable. He can choose to be happy. Yud kei vav kei, embedded backwards. V'chol zei neno shoveli. Here's an amazing medrash that Rechaim Kanievsky brings to our attention. Amazing. The medrash says that the tree, the gallows, what type of wood was it? So the Medrash says that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to gather, figure out which would be the wood to hang Haman, so he called out to the trees in the Garden of Eden, and he said, who wants to be the one? Kara HaKadosh Baruch Hu, l'chol atzei breishis, mi yitein atzmo v'yitol l'rosh ezeh alav. Who wants to be the one that will be, that will, the one that will, Haman will be hanged upon? And the Te'ena Amra, the Te'ena says, the fig said, Ani etain, I want to be. The Te'ena went first. Why the Te'ena? Why the fig? Because according to the Gemara in Brachas Daf Mem, one of the major opinions is that that was the tree that Adam made his big, great mistake. That's why he was covered by the loin, his loins were covered by the Alei Te'ena, by the leaves of Te'ena. So what's the Nekuda here? One of the most important ideas is that when we look at Haman and we say, oh, you know, he's miserable. Well, sometimes I'm miserable also. We have choices also. The big ikar of Purim is, I can choose who I want to be. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu judges us dafka in that makom bechira. And that's the amud hagadol, the ikar hagadol of Jewish life. That's the Tzelem Elokim, says the Meshech Chachma.
I'd like to give you two possible interpretations on this idea of Haman being attached to the tree of knowledge, the Eitz Hadas, right? We said, what is the source for Haman in the Torah? And the Gemara tells us, Hamin ha-Eitz Hadas, that Haman is Hamin ha-Eitz Hadas, right, for the tree of knowledge. So, first idea. What was the problem with them eating from the tree? Right? Doesn't Judaism values Das, knowledge? I mean, it's the apex for the Rambam, for Maimonides, the apex of Jewish life is to come to a level of Das, of knowing God. And yet, this was a bad thing for Adam and Eve. The very thing which Judaism is recommending as the purpose of your existence here on this earth, at least according to the Rambam, is the very thing that Adam and Eve are faulted for. So what was the sin? Perhaps the sin was the following. You know, sometimes in life, knowledge is neutral. Knowledge is neutral. It's the morality that you put behind that knowledge that determines whether or not your knowledge will be used for good or bad. You put the wrong knowledge in the hands of somebody who's immoral, and he could turn it into a bomb to blow people up. You put that same knowledge in someone's hands, and they could use the same raw elements to be able to create a medicine that could heal people. Knowledge is neutral. There was nothing wrong with the tree. But maybe God was saying, you're not ready yet. You just were born into the world. You haven't experienced any bit of life yet. And you're going to gain all this knowledge. Knowledge without experience is a recipe for disaster. Think of probably a bunch of high school kids you taught over the years. Have these kids who haven't experienced anything yet, who think they know everything because their SAT score is higher than anybody else. But those are the most dangerous. When you think you know everything, but you haven't lived yet, That knowledge is the most dangerous in the world. And therefore God was saying, not yet. Not yet. You'll get to it soon. I'm going to give you das soon, whether that came later with the manna or whenever else. God was going to give them das later on. So that's the lesson that I think one pshat of Ad Lo Yada. Ad Lo Yada is the rectification of Hamin Ha'etz Das. The Ad Lo Yada is fixing it by saying, I recognize now that sometimes I have to acknowledge that my knowledge is not a good thing. Is das a good thing? Yes. Do you need to know? Yes. If someone is drunk, they can't give an answer about a halacha. I remember one year the Rebbe was drunk. They asked him about whether we're sober enough to daven Maariv. And the Rebbe was in a catch-22. The Rebbe couldn't answer the question because he can't answer the question while you're drunk. So therefore, since he couldn't answer, he knew he was too drunk to daven Maariv. But you understand that it's a crazy eight. He couldn't answer the question of whether he couldn't daven Maariv. But he knew he couldn't daven Maariv because he was too drunk. But how could he answer the question? That's pasuk halacha. But separately. But sometimes we have to acknowledge that we're not ready yet to know. That's Ad Lo Yada. The second idea of Ad Lo Yada. A few weeks ago in our shul, we had a big Talmud Chacham. You know, his name is Reb Chaskel Weinfeld, the Lev Avram, son of the Lev Avram. Reb Chaskel Weinfeld has 25 pages in Ad Lo Yada in his Sefer. A beautiful piece. If you can see it, it's incredible. And he wanted to argue that what was Ad Lo Yada about? So Haman comes from Amalek. Amalek is Gematria Suffolk. Doubt. Says Rav Weinfeld, you know what Amalek was coming to do? Great chap. Amalek was not coming to put doubt in your head. You have doubt every single day when you wake up. Right? You live every day as... it's so good. I'm sorry to take a little longer. The Pasuk in Daniel says that Shushan Habira was in a bigger province called Elam. Elam, which was on the river Avel Ulai. And Rav Kook says, we Jews are used to living on the riverbanks of Aval Ulai, of maybe, of perhaps. We always live dancing in the shadow of doubt, trying to face doubt head on. So what was Haman doing and Amalek doing? Amalek wasn't trying to give us doubt, says Rav Weinfeld. Amalek was trying to tell us, you can't live with doubt. You can't live with doubt. You need certainty. This thing is doubtful here. Are you going to make it through the midbar? You can't live with that doubt. Is Moshe ever going to come back down the mountain? You can't live with doubt. Right? You can't live like... It's not a way to live. Can you actually survive going into Israel as the Meraglim came back? You can't live with doubt. The lesson of Amalek and Haman is that you should not feel comfortable living with doubt. The answer of Ad Lo Yada is, as one philosopher put it, the courage for disillusionment. The courage to say, I don't know everything. The courage for a Jew to be comfortable living in the space when you're unsure is Moshe coming right now or later. That's where a Jew has to be comfortable living. And Rav Kook says our whole lives, the Jews have always survived living on the banks of the river, Evel Ulai. On the banks of the river of doubt. That's where a Jew flourishes, not in the banks of the river of certainty. That's in God's realm. We live on the banks of the river of doubt.
Fantastic. So I just want to it's always nice to work off the ideas. The Sfas Emes says something very similar in a totally different context. He wonders, you look in the Megillah, you'll see the holiday of Purim was established not on the day of victory, but rather when? The day after. The day of rest. People ask this question. Rav Chaim Kinevsky, others, people, why did they? Usually it's the Yom She'ir Bones. You with me? The day that they won the war. Why are we doing it the day of rest, the day afterwards? That's strange. So the Sfas Emes gives a majestic answer. So I want to read to you his beautiful words. He says, the Tachlis Milchemes Amalek, because remember, Purim is always about that Amalek story, because Amalek's whole purpose is Levatel HaMenucha. Their whole purpose is to rid a person of a place of serenity. As it says, Asher Karcha Baderech, they always catch you when you're on the road, right? On the road, when you're traveling, you're not feeling it. Even the people in business class, one zocher to see a few of them, right? Or first class, even they're on the road. You know, I flew first class a few weeks ago. It was just a bimikriya. Please don't judge me. I had to make sure that there were people that were in economy, because you can't be first class unless there's people in economy. So you have to go every once in a while check to see that they're there, Baruch Hashem. So when I went to get my luggage, I was very distressed, because I always was under the illusion that the first class passengers get their luggage like first, like special. And I don't know, I feel like I was like on the line with everybody else. Like, it was like, what happened here? Like, you know, what, you know, come on. You know, so when a person is traveling, they're feeling no menucha. Amalek always is about getting us in the desert, getting us on the road. And Amalek in the Purim story is also about getting us in a place of doubt. Says the Sfas Emes, the celebration of Purim, which is the celebration of the destruction of the Koach of Amalek, can only be found when the Jews were nachu me'oyevehem, when they have a sense of menucha. And then he says like this, this is so beautiful, and many people are familiar with this idea. Chazal say that when it comes to Amalek, God's throne, his kisei, is not shalem, his throne is not complete until Amalek is wiped out. Kisei, sitting, relaxation, throne, menucha, it's all the same imagery. The imagery of Amalek is you're not sitting. The imagery of Amalek is you're like constantly feeling like distress and stress, etc. The anti-Amalek is wherever you go, you feel menucha. You can be in the most stressful situation, but Chovas HaLevavos teaches us, when a Jew has a sense of God is with me, Atah Imadi, you can be in the most difficult places. And you could still feel an internal sense of menuchas hanefesh. The defeat of Amalek and the Purim story is dafka on the day of menucha, not the day of war.
Very good.
Beautiful Sfas Emes.
Very good. So Achashverosh writes a letter that the Jews are eligible to defend themselves. And it's a great celebration, they can defend themselves. Wait a second. If the Jews were powerless to defend themselves, what point is it to have a letter that says you can now defend yourself? If the Jews were able to defend themselves, without the letter, I highly doubt they were going to sit there and just wait to be killed.
Yeah.
What'd the letter do? So in the Tshuvas El Ami by Rav Amiel, who was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he said, it shows you the Jews were always powerful enough to defeat the enemy at that point in history. But they needed to hear it. They needed a letter to tell them that they can do it. And he says, we had to wait for the UN to tell us that Israel is ours, for us really to come back. Over and over, the Jew throughout history is waiting to hear from the rest of the world, are we entitled enough to stand up for ourselves? Are we valid enough? Do we deserve this? And says the Tshuva Selami, the lesson that the Jews should have learned is that we didn't need to wait for Achashverosh's permission to stand up for ourselves, to recognize what our power truly is. There's a great story, the Hasidic story. They say the greatest tishin were held by the student of the Baal Shem Tov, the Belzer Rebbe, the student of the Mezutra Magid, the Belzer Rebbe. So the Belzer Rebbe was first the Baal Korah. He used to read the Megillah by the Mezutra Magid. He was the famous Baal Korah, and then he became his own dynasty. And at his Suda was always the wildest things would happen. And one year, in a famous fight there where someone came out dressed as a soldier, the Belzer Rebbe wanted to calm everybody down because it was getting crazy. And he told them this story. There was a couple who could not have children. And they went to the Baal Shem Tov, the miracle worker. And they went to the Baal Shem Tov. They said to the Baal Shem Tov, please, give us a child. And the Baal Shem Tov says, I'm going to daven to God to open the gates for you. And he went to daven, but he comes back with tears and he said, I'm sorry, it's closed. There's nothing I could do. I tried. They said, there must be something we could do. They said, well, there is someone whose prayers are more powerful than mine. So they go, no, where is he? It's just two towns over. So let's go, send me to him. So the Baal Shem Tov said, the problem is he's drunk all day. He's Moishel of the Shikr. So, but if you can get him to sober up and give you a bracha, I'm sure he could open the gates. He goes two towns over, the husband, to go find Moishel of the Shikr. Where are you going to find Moishel of the Shikr if not in the tavern? He goes to the local tavern and he asks, do you guys know where Moishel of the Shikr is? They're laughing. You want to go sit with Moishel of the Shikr? He's drunkard in the back of the tavern. He goes and he sees a real Nebuch-looking human being, drunk, lying there in his own vomit, sitting there on the floor. And he says, Moishel, I'm here for a bracha from you for children. Moishel is laughing with his bottle pouring all over him. And he knows he's not going to get a bracha out of this Moishel like this. He comes up with a chap, right? Kotzker says the Jew always has to find another way. So he comes up with a chap. The night when the Moishel is leaving to go to sleep for a couple minutes before he comes back for a drink, we're going to take him in the wagon. We're going to tie him down. And we'll sober him up. They take Moishlo the Shikr, they grab him, they tie him down, they take him for 3 days, no drinks. They sober him up, give him water, hydrate him, sober him up. Turns to Moishlo the Shikr and says, Moishlo, give me a bracha for children. Moishlo closes his eyes and you could feel the earth moving and the gates opening. Moishlo says, you can go back home now. Mm-hmm. Untie me. He unties him. Moishlo Shikr runs back to the tavern. He goes home, and lo and behold, his wife is pregnant. They have a baby 9 months later. They go to the Baal Shem Tov and says, one thing that bothered us throughout this whole thing is why God would put such power in the hands of such a lushik. Why would he put such power in the hands of such a human being? And says the Baal Shem Tov, because if that human being only recognized what his power is, the world would come to an end. Says the Belzer Rebbe, on Purim we're so busy with all the dancing and the drinking and the laughing and the games and the costumes and the Shalach Manas, but God did it on purpose. He wanted us to distract us for a minute from us realizing how powerful we truly are. Because if all of us realized how powerful we truly are on Purim, we'd open up all the gates and the Mashiach would be here already.
I want to end with a story, with the Lord and the story. I want to thank Rabbi Einhorn for his beautiful Torah. It's always a pleasure. It's always a great pleasure. A lot of nachas. The Vilna Gaon quotes a famous Medrash. The Medrash says that Mordechai was depressed after hearing about the Gezerah, the decree, and he saw some kids. And the Chabadniks know this Medrash in their sleep. He saw some, he said, what are you learning? And he quotes a Pasuk. The Pasuk says, Al tira mi pachad pitom. Don't be afraid from quick, sudden fear. Don't be afraid. And then he goes to another group, goes, what are you learning? He goes, Utsu Eitza v'tufar. They seek counsel, but they'll be annulled. Dabru davar v'lo yakum. They're going to try to plot. It's not going to work. And then the final pasuk is, Vad zikna nihu. Third set of kids. Vad I'm with God. Excuse me. Vad zikna nihu. Vad seva ni esbol. Vad zikna. Hashem says, God says, I am, even though I'm old, I'm still there. But Sevani as well. So what are these three psukim? And when Mordechai heard this, he felt really good. So what's going on here? So this says the Vilna Gaon, an amazing thing. I'm going to focus on the last one in a moment. He said, these are the three times Amalek comes on us. The first one is they can't, suddenly. Al tiro mi pachad pitom. Suddenly, asher karcha baderech. Don't worry, God has you covered. The second one, without going into the details, they got dressed up as Canaanites. They really were Amalekites, and the Jews weren't sure who they were fighting against, so they made an ambiguous prayer, Im nason titenas amazeb yadi. This is in Bamidbar chapter 21, I think. Parshas Chukas. Im nason titenas amazeb yadi. They got dressed up with a council, they plotted. And then the third time is the Purim story, and the Gemara tells us that Haman says to Ahasuerus, don't worry about their God, he's old. Their God is old. When I was a kid, what do you mean he's old? Never understood that. But the truth is, what Haman was really saying is, their God has forsaken them. Their God has forsaken them. He's gotten sick of them. He's not with them anymore. He's replaced them. We've heard echoes of that idea. And therefore, that's what, Yeshno Am Echad, there's a, Yeshenim, and their God is Yashin. Their God is, so he's had it with them. And therefore Hashem says, Vazikna nihu, no, I'm always there. You think I'm old, I'm always there. Anias, Vatsev Anias Bol. So let me tell you a story. Make this point real. Yosef Friedenson, the editor of Das Yiddish Avart for about 45 years. He was an amazing Jew. You can Google all about him. But his grandson told the following story. Well, he told the story, the grandson related. That they were in a work camp. It was Simchas Torah, and the German work detail did not show up. So one of the chevras started singing the famous song, Ein Adir Kahashem, Ein Baruch Keben Amram, Ein Gidulah Katorah. There's no one as strong as God. There's nobody as blessed as Moshe Rabbeinu. There's nothing as great as the Torah. The guard burst in, yelling at them, what are you singing? Friedenson, what are you singing? Are you praying for our downfall? No, said Friedenson. And he started to translate the song. There is no one as powerful as our God. No one as blessed as Moses. There are no people as wise as Jewish people. At that point, listen to this story. The guard interrupted, yelling on top of his lungs, Friedenson, you believe that? Look at you. Hitler is killing all of you. And you believe that you are the smartest people? Do you believe? My Zaidi, the grandson related, said at that point, no one had an answer until finally from the back of the bunk, a young Jew, whom Isaiah described as not even being religious, piped up and replied in a strong voice, Ya, ich glaub, I believe. The bunk fell silent, then each one of them followed suit, replying to the guard, Ich glaub, I believe. As if in a state of shock, the guard stood frozen, staring at all of them, and he replied, I'm afraid that Hitler will never be able to destroy people like you. And he stormed out of the room. This is the koach of the emuna of the Jew, the adzikna anihu, HaKadosh Baruch Hu never gives up on the Jew. And we never give up on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And this is one of the key messages of Purim to take us, Bezaz Hashem, to the ultimate redemption. As Rabbi Einhorn said so beautifully, Purim will be with us till the very end. Bezaz Hashem, we should be zoche to have Purim HaShlema, Eretz Yisrael HaShalem, v'mehera b'yameinu, amen v'amen.
Thank you.